Brighten up your home with help from Menards. Illuminate your home with LED light bulbs from Fight Electric. They provide light that lasts with a rated life of over 10,000 hours. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Fight Electric LED light bulbs now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Finish your year with your dream kitchen with help from Menards. Clearview Cabinetry offers a selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft closed doors and drawers and cabinet accessories to match your unique style. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Clearview Cabinets and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of The Dark Hustle. Thank you so much for listening to my podcast and subscribing and following us. It's super cool. You guys are the best. Also, if you are not a member of our Patreon, what are you doing? Go check it out. It's got multiple levels to choose from, and we have early access over there for all of our episodes and a bunch of other stuff. So go check us out on Patreon.
Hello.
Hey,
is this Gray?
It is.
Hey, it's Brianna.
Hey, Brianna, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing all right. Trying to survive this heat.
I was fixing to say, you're fixing the show.
Yeah, I'm off today. I don't show again until tomorrow, so at least I got a little break today.
Well, very cool. So, all right, hold on. Let me just start from the beginning. You and your husband are a team.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, yeah, and because I spoke to him last week, but you also do, so he has his own deal, but you're also a vet, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, that's what I thought, but you still help out as far as training and all that kind of stuff goes.
No, I'm actually a non-pro, so I don't do anything other than be supportive to him. I do clean stalls and that kind of stuff, but nothing training wise. That's all him.
Cleaning stalls is therapeutic. I don't care what anybody says.
I do too. I kind of find it cathartic. I feel like there's a lot of people that don't actually enjoy that, but man, when people have been talking to you all day, it's really nice to go in there and just do something very repetitive.
Yeah, it's good thinking time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So how did you get into horses? How did you kind of end up where you are now?
Well, you know, honestly, I think I knew I wanted to be a veterinarian from like a very, very early age. I grew up in Alabama and quite honestly in the city, like Birmingham, Alabama, no green grass around, like it just a little suburb of that area. But I had a mother who was very interested in animals and kind of exposed me to that and let me adopt a dog. And I checked out a book when I was 3 years old, and I went to like more of the young adult section and checked out this book at the library called Animal Doctor. And I looked at the pictures. I obviously couldn't read at that time, but I looked at the pictures and I looked at my mom and I said, that's what I want to be when I grow up. So at 3 years old, I kind of decided that's my life. And then
that's kind of cool. Not a lot of people can say that.
It was a very like crowning or very accurate moment in my life to like decide at that age that that's what I wanted to do. But that never went away. Like there was never a point where I was like, that's not what I want to do. It just, you know, there were definitely some struggles and hiccups along the way getting there, but it was absolutely what I wanted to do. My mother had wanted to ride horses when she was younger, and she kind of got to a little bit, but she was the one that kind of advocated and pushed for me to be able to ride. And I started riding when I was 8 years old, grew up riding in the Alabama Hunter Jumper Association with White Horse Farm and Barbara Grubbs and her two daughters. And they gave me a foundation in riding in the English and went on to compete in hunters until I think up through college. I was competing in the Hunter Association with several horses along the way, and that's kind of how I started in riding. When I came out here, I came out here with the one horse I still had, and he was kind of getting towards the end of his career. And about that time, I met my husband, and ironically, there's a funny story about that. He rode Western, right? Like, he was a team roper when I met him, right? And I knew he kind of rode other disciplines growing up. So I was currently riding this horse in dressage, right? And I was like, I'm going to sit you on this horse and see what happens. And I've got a picture of it somewhere. And I was very impressed. He actually made that horse look better than I did. And I was like, well, I guess you do know what you're talking about.
I'm just trying to make sure what kind.
Yeah, no, you have to, right? You have to test what
you
level.
You do.
What
I'm
level they actually are on. So he kind of impressed me that day. And there's a picture sitting on our mantle to this day of him in that dressage saddle. I don't know if he'd show anybody, but it's there. Because I took one, was like, this is proof. But anyway, that horse kind of needed to be retired a few months later. So he still currently lives in my retirement field now. But he had like suspensory desmitis, and he got sore, and I was like, okay, buddy, you can have your retirement. And so, you know, he's like 10 years later now, 11 years later, he's had a long retirement, but he's still out there living his best life.
We did that too with two particular horses. They were the ones that, you know, they're going to stay here for life, and they're buried out there on the hill.
Yeah. If they earn it, I think they deserve it. So I definitely have my retirement field, which has several in it at this point in time, but they're happy. So that's what matters. Yeah. They did their time working for us.
So she said, you're a team roper. Let's slap you on a dressage horse.
Yeah. Let's see how this rolls. And I swear he could have showed that horse better than I could have. So, anyway,
that's
cool. We jokingly
that's
say
cool, though.
Should, yeah. We definitely say he should go show the hunters. He just won't wear the pants.
Well, I mean, that's funny that happened because, you know, and he can probably agree with this as well, that the statement of being able to do that will actually, like, send you lengths ahead of everybody else. If you're able to go outside of your box and do other things, I think it'll help you ride
Absolutely. The
main discipline that you're trying to ride.
Absolutely. And that's his foundation was so good in the all around that he's able to adapt and ride so many different disciplines. You know, he just concentrates on the ranch now, but he technically can ride a lot of different things. And then once that horse had kind of had to be retired, he was working for someone in the Appaloosa industry, and they had a little mare. He thought I should try because I decided I was going to do Western if I was in Oklahoma. It might as well be time to, like, join the club. So I was going to learn how to do Western. And he said he took me to the Appaloosa World because he was assisting for somebody down there in the team roping. And he said I should try this mare while we're down there. And we get down there, and he goes to lunge this thing. And, I mean, we'd only been dating for 30 days, and this thing went around, like, a flying kite. Like, it was bucking and running and rearing, and I was looking at him like, are you trying to kill me? Like, what's going on here? And then he's like, you want me to ride her first? And I'm like, well, yeah, that did look super fun. And he gets on her, and she's fine. And we went on to purchase that mare, and that's actually the first mare I ever won a trophy on. So, I mean, he did
oh,
a good
wow.
job there, but I still sure didn't think he was trying to kill me when I first watched her lunge. She never did get better at lunging either.
Well, I mean, you know, you still have to have talent in order to show her to win that too. So, you know, I mean, you've obviously come a long way as well because you didn't meet him at a young age. You were already riding
No.
before you met him.
I think I was like 28, maybe somewhere in that ballpark before I met him. I'd already graduated college and was a veterinarian and everything out here. So definitely. I had a foundation, but he taught me everything I know about Western riding, so that's all his help.
Well, that's pretty cool. I mean, but it's cool that, you know, you also kind of had your own deal first. What was it he said? It was so funny. He said it last week. He said that somebody told him, don't ever try to teach somebody that you've seen naked. And
yes, that is a Chris Dawson quote from one of his podcasts, and he tells everybody that. And, I mean, it follows true. Like, we definitely get into our spats and hurt feelings and everything else, but at the end of the day, we're on the same team, and we can work through it.
Well, I mean, you got to be able to do it. What's the whole meme about don't work cattle with your spouse?
Oh,
which
my gosh.
It's so weird to me.
No.
Because I've never really actually seen anybody fight when they work cattle. It's always like.
I have experienced it firsthand. So.
Brighten up your home with help from Menards. Illuminate your home with LED light bulbs from Fight Electric. They provide light that lasts with a rated life of over 10,000 hours. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Fight Electric LED light bulbs now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
I dread cattle day. I dread vaccinating those things, and I'm not a cattle vet by any means, so that's probably not helping.
She'll wake up and go, I'm sick today.
Right. Yeah, and he tells me to, you know, cowboy up, you're coming.
So are you a small animal vet or a large, or what exactly?
I primarily, and try real hard to primarily work on just horses. I dabble in some other animals. I actually came out to Oklahoma for a 1-year internship at a practice here called Equine Medical Associates. And I, at the end of that year, just kind of liked being in Oklahoma, a lot of horse industry. I had planned originally to go back home, but fell in love with the area, fell in love with the fact that you can go to a horse event just about every weekend if you want to. And I wanted to stay, so I stayed on that practice. And I worked there for, I think, around 14 years, somewhere in that ballpark. And this past December, I actually moved to a new place, and it is Great Plains Veterinary Services, and it is actually a mixed animal practice. So it's a 5-doctor practice, and several of them are primarily small animal, but myself and the owner of that practice work on the large animals. She's a little bit more any species that walks in the door, which is quite impressive if you ask me. I've seen her work on elk, and there's pictures of her working on mountain lions. I mean, she's just one of those incredibly gifted people that can work on any animal that walks through the door. But I primarily do the equine side and occasionally patch some of the other critters that she can't get to. But equine is my passion.
That is pretty cool,
though. Specialty.
That she can do that. Like, because I'm your average person. I would think if you're going to go, the vet is not a big, you know, balloon term for that. You know, if you're going to be a vet, it's usually a specialty, like exotics or large or small.
Yes.
Or something of that. You know, that's usually what you hear. So that is really kind of cool that she can do that.
It's impressive to me, honestly. She's like that old James Herriot adage, you know, that all creatures great and small, and she really, truly is. And it's been kind of fun getting to learn some things from her for that reason.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet so. Yeah, you're sitting with a wealth of knowledge.
Yep, sure am. You know, and I love it. My passion's still always going to lie with the horses, though. That's what I understand. That's the ones I get along with the best. That's still my calling, but it is fun to be there in that mixed environment.
Yeah. So I take it you work on all of your own horses, and then you also work on your customer horses?
For the most part, there are a few things that I just don't want to do, to my own especially. You know, I'm not a big fan of surgery. I like a lot of the sports medicine. I like the emergency work, but I don't really like the surgical side. So those are some things I refer out. And plus, it's not real fun. I've been scrubbed in on a colic surgery on one of my own before, and it's just not the most fun place to be in staring at the inside of your own horse's internal organs.
Oh, God.
So I think those are that you have to, as an owner, you have to be able to step back and say, should I? I know I can do this, but should I do this to my own? It's kind of like, you know, parents shouldn't work on their own children if they're a doctor to some degree. Like, there's certain things you probably refer out, and I feel like that's kind of the same for us. But on the whole, yeah, I do most of our vet work and the client vet work, as well as a large clientele in this area.
Yeah, I've always had a great respect for vets because I remember when I was small, I had the idea that I was going to be one too. Not small like you, like we were in 4-H, we were around it, you know what I mean? So I thought, okay, well, yeah. I was going to be a vet. And I went on a call with one, and I got to stick my hand inside the side of a cow. And I knew right then, I was like, and I'm not, like, blood guts doesn't bother me, but I knew then, I was like, yeah, I'm not going to be a vet.
This is not my calling.
This is not for me.
And that, you know, that's a good thing to learn.
Major props.
Yes. It's not for everybody. I mean, it is definitely, it has to be a passion. Because, you know, there's not any point in veterinary medicine where you go into it expecting to get rich. Like you can in other industries. We work a lot of hours. We don't get rich. I mean, everybody thinks we are because we're charging for it. But honestly, those drugs cost money. So it can be a little bit of a struggle. So it's got to be a passion. It's got to be something you want to do, love to do. You know, that's what it is for me. And I think that's an important thing to ponder if you're anticipating wanting to go to vet school is why do you want to go? And I think love of animals or want to, you know, improve their quality of life has to be a big part of why you want to go.
Yeah. Well, and they also say, I mean, you know, I think it's a good thing that I think it's admirable and honorable. You've got to have a lot of strength to be able to do what you do as for a living. You know, vet care is what, you know, pays your bills, but you're also still around it on the outside of that, you know, in your personal life and family life and things of that nature. And I think that's strong to be able to do that because vets go through a lot of, you guys have got to be mentally tough.
That is a very true statement. You got to be a little thick-skinned to be a vet. But, you know, what's good for me, like being a part of the horse industry, it gives me kind of a unique perspective. And I actually think it helps my ability to practice more effectively because I have both the medical aspect of it, but I also have the rider's aspect. Like, you know, I can visit with my clients about what are they feeling? When does it feel wrong? What is the horse doing? How is it reacting to you when you put your leg on here? Is it drifting in the turns? Like those are all things that I know and have knowledge of from my own riding career. And it kind of can help me, especially like, you know, you talk about lameness work. It helps me be able to find what we're looking for a little bit better because of that knowledge and them being able to communicate with me what they're feeling. And then the other part is just being around that creature so much, you almost get to like a sixth sense of, you know, is this pain or is this something else? Being able to kind of determine what you should be looking for. And I think that's a unique perspective. Not all of the equine vets are riders, you know, it's a very select group of us. In fact, I think there's probably more, and I don't know this for a fact, but I feel like there's probably more small animal vets that go into riding and then large animal vets. And I think part of that's just the time commitment that a large animal vet has. You know, a lot of small animal practice, it's 8 to 5 plus some. I mean, obviously they're not working a straight 8 to 5, but a lot of them have referral after hours programs where in the equine industry, it's a little bit more that kind of 24/7 type concept and hasn't really adapted as much to the referral program. We have them obviously, but still, if you're in a rural area and the next practice over that's a referral center 2 hours away, there's a lot of times where you're a 24/7 vet, and that changes the dynamic. But either way, you know, I think it's an advantage to be involved in the horse industry for sure.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And then, you know, well, just the sheer fact of, I guess, working on animals has got to be more emotionally straining for a person because obviously you have to be passionate. You have to care to even go into the field, you know. I mean, look at me. I stuck my hand in my cow. I'm like, no. So to see it through and to do it, do all that, you know, it's not like you're working with people that can reason with you and talk to you. You're working with animals that I think I just think you guys are so emotionally tough to be able to do it. And they even talk about the statistics of vets, you know, and the suicide rates of vets and the things you guys have to go through. And it's just amazing to me that y'all are able to do that.
It is. The statistics are not great, and they're accurate, too, unfortunately. We have one of the highest occupational suicide rates there is. And I think that's a multifocal problem, and I don't know what the solution is, but you've got a couple issues. And one is you come out of vet school commonly with a very, very large amount of debt. And and this is, you know, there's different salaries you can come out making. But if we just isolate the equine industry, equine veterinarians as a whole are paid less than any other veterinary pursuit. So when you're talking about coming out and getting an internship, which I feel like is advantageous to coming out of school because you're prepared with school, but you don't have that real world aspect of seeing right. those clinical cases. So having that mentor program is incredibly important to becoming a good vet. But you're talking about coming out of vet school and like back when I came out, like the starting salary was around, I think it was 28,000. I mean, that's hard. And so you've got mm-hmm. this debt that an average, I think around, it was several hundred thousand when I graduated, and you're that's your salary. So you're sitting there going, how do I pay this back? So you've got stress, mental stress from debt. And then on top of that, you have case stress, and case stress can be multifocal. One, can I fix this? You know, that I think that's the most basic thing. Am I doing right by this animal? I mean, I can't count the number of times I wake up in the middle of the night going, God, did I do right by that horse? Am I okay? Am I doing right? Stressing about, is this colic okay? Is the horse I saw for a laceration last week doing good? Like, I cannot tell you how many times I just wake up wondering that. And then you even have more, and I think this has become more and more recently with the advent of like social media, you have client issues. And although I have some of the best clients in the world, and I consider many of my clients friends, there have been some along the way, you know, that either accuse you of being a horrible person because you can't do your job for free, or are mad that you can't
what
save
blows
the animal.
My mind, not right. to interrupt, but that blows right. my mind that people think that you should get a service that doesn't cost, like, how can you expect to run a business and do it good no matter what you're doing and right. not have money involved? Like,
and
really?
It's sad for us too. We want, like, we are compassionate. We want to save those animals, and we get into that moment where there is no funds for that, and we're doing the best we can by them, but we also have to be able to eat and provide for our families, and it's yeah. a tough tightrope to walk, and so many of us will find the way to discount and do the best we can by those, and you still have people that are angry that tell you, well, you must not love animals because you're not saving this animal, and that's a really tough rock to be under. That combined stress of those items adds up for a lot of people, and it can be just so daunting. And I think that's where we get into that. And we've lost a lot, even just in the last few years, of people to that. And I hate that that's a part of our job. And I think what makes it even worse, especially when you're talking about the client aspect, is the fact that there is no repercussion if they post on social media that this vet so-and-so.
Don't even get me started on that.
Right, right. Like, I mean, I've recently seen TikToks degrading a vet. It just, there is no repercussion for that fact. And even if the vet did everything right, that statement alone is on the internet for people to see, which may affect their future practice. And I think that's a lot of the stress for a lot of these veterinarians, and including me. Like, I'm not immune to it either.
This is probably an aspect that nobody, well, maybe they have thought about it, I don't know, but you guys don't, it's not, you're still medical, like the mm-hmm. school that you said you had to go to, all that, the debt, everything, it's still kind of the same caliber of, you know, as a regular doctor, a human doctor.
Correct.
You know, you guys are still on up there, but you don't have that backup. Like, humans have insurance, and you have the insurance companies, and you have those things that they can fight it out, and they have some type of backup for your security. Vets don't necessarily have that. It's not like you can call.
We actually do. We have things like AVMA, PLIT insurance, and things that we can have as insurance.
From the customer's perspective, you know, when a customer
right.
comes in and not
it's come up a lot more now recently as far as horses is concerned. I've seen more people get horse insurance in the last couple of years than I have.
Yeah, okay, from the healthcare aspect of it, yes.
Right, you know.
And I do feel like there is more horse insurance out there, but it's not a perfect system either because it's not like human industry where that's the standard. It's the thing you can do as an extra, as an owner, which I encourage clients to do because it is some, and I have insurance on my own horses because of that fact, because I don't want to worry about money when I'm trying to make a life-changing decision, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. No, I completely, totally agree. But I think maybe since the industry has come up so much in the last 5 or 6 years and the value of horses have come up more, just like your husband said, you know, that bar is kind of set now. I mean, not that it's not going to go back down, but it's set different now. It just is. Maybe that kind of awakened people in the industry to go, okay, we have to look at these things like we do cars that have to have car insurance. They're okay.
Right.
They have the insurance company they can back up on. Regular doctors, they have insurance companies they can back up on, you know, as far as the customer is concerned. Whereas before, your average Joe Blow with a horse did not have horse insurance. It was like, you know, if we went to a vet, we got to figure out how to pay you. You've got to figure out how to do what you're doing, you know.
Right. And I think horse insurance is a good thing. You know, I don't know that it ever should be something required because of the sense that our healthcare industry it's got its own set of problems. And I hate to see some of those problems come over into the veterinary industry. But I do think, you know, I think it's advantageous for owners, especially if you question, can you come up with the money for a colic surgery or for a substantial injury? Just have that peace of mind with that insurance. I don't think that's wrong by any means.
Yeah. It helps both sides of it. Helps you. It helps the owner. Helps the horse. But I can't imagine having to sit there. And I got to give you guys props because to sit there and have to make those types of decisions on something that you know is somebody's pride and joy and things of that nature are cost a lot of money. That's a lot of pressure on a person.
It is. And I think, I don't know, there's not a simple answer to that. I think we just have to do the best we can. And I think go into that with the understanding that you're doing right by as many animals as you possibly can. And that's what keeps me going, you know. For any case that didn't work out, I've got 10 other cases over here that had wonderful outcomes, and you have to focus on that. You have to train yourself to be okay and focus on everything good to be able to survive the things that didn't work out quite how you wanted to.
Right.
I think that holds in anything you do in life, including sewing. I mean, that's just a good standard. Just focus on the good and don't dwell on the bad. It's a tough one. I'll tell you that. It's a mental game. A good one.
Yeah, just think about the positive and forget about the rest.
right, for sure.
So when you, did you go to school in Alabama and then moved to Oklahoma for your internship?
Correct. I did my undergrad at Auburn University. I did a master's at Auburn, and then I did my veterinary school at Tuskegee University. Alabama, when I was in school, was the only state with two veterinary schools within the state. So I was actually, and they're like 20 minutes apart.
Oh, wow.
So it kind of gave you two in-state options to go to vet school. And I got into Tuskegee, and it was a really good program for me. It allowed me to have a lot of things that I got to do in the equine industry, that I may not have had the opportunity to do at other vet schools. One of the things being I was one of the strongest equine people in my class. So I did get to do a lot of things equine just because of that statement. And two, because that university really believed in letting the students have a lot of hands-on. So we were managing cases, and I think that helps the whole industry get better by being able to be those people practicing, obviously under the supervision of a head clinician, but it did give us a lot of experience within the school itself.
That's what I was fixing to ask. So when you say cases, people could actually bring like customers, the university had customers, and you guys actually
correct.
Got to, okay, well, that's
correct.
Cool.
And most vet schools have a teaching hospital. It's called a teaching hospital. You know, you understand that if you go there, both the clinician and the students will be working on your animal, and that's small or large. But it gives you a good option because they usually have clinicians that are really specialty at the things they're specializing in, board certified, et cetera. So you're getting some of the highest educated people to work on whatever animal you're working on. And then the manpower, a lot of it is coming from your student body, which is people that are really at this point in their life very interested about learning and caring for their patient like as much as they can. So I think it gives the, you know, owners and clients an opportunity to get that quality care and also to help, you know, the upcoming veterinary population. But it did, you know, it does give you us a chance to learn while we're still in school before we go out into the world and have to practice by ourselves.
Now, were you shocked when you kind of come out of college and went to the real, when you went into your internship, or were you felt like you were kind of really prepared, or was it one of those situations where, you know, you get a degree and then you're like, okay, now we're starting all over again?
It has a couple different answers to it. What I will say is I'm very glad I was involved in horses a lot and knew them really well. I think being able to be a good horseman is what has helped me in a lot of my veterinary medicine. I was here in Oklahoma for 3 days before I got put on call. I had some backup, like phone call backup, to be able to talk to some of the owners of that practice, but I definitely got asked to be on call that first week. And so that first weekend I had my first emergency call, and looking back on it, you know, I've learned a lot since then. Everything went okay, but I think I probably would do something different. So I think the answer is veterinary school prepares you to some degree. But I think the real world is probably eye-opening for many, and I hit the ground running, but that's always kind of been my mentality, and I've been in the industry so long, I could walk in and for one thing, just communicate with the clients. I think horse people have their own thought processes about everything we do, and I think being able to be a part of that community has helped me just jump in. So I felt okay. I was ready to go from day one, but I could see where, you know, there's a lot of people in vet school that decide they want to work on equine while in vet school because they fall in love with it, and that's got to be a little bit more daunting coming out than, say, a person that's been in the industry forever and kind of knows a lot of the ins and outs of it. Not to say that they can't pull it off, but I would think they would enjoy mentorship even more, just to have that segue into private practice.
Was there anybody special that you, when you say mentorship, I mean, was there anybody special that kind of just helped you
There's
get
been
into
a lot.
It?
And, and it depends on what area we talk about. Like when I was in Alabama, there's two vets that come to mind. And the first is the first one I ever met on equine practice, Dr. Barbara Benhart. And Dr. Benhart, super cool lady. She actually drove around in a Cadillac. That was her practice vehicle. And I remember being at horse camp one time, and it was middle of winter. I think it was like a December Christmas camp or something. And we were all freezing, but the horse had colicked. And so we were all staying up. And I mean, I think we were sleeping under horse blankets to watch this horse because we were all horse crazy kids. And I remember meeting Dr. Benhart at that point and just being so impressed and so, like, you know, almost like an idol, like, you're who I want to be when I grow up. So I think just working with her and getting to learn from her on my own horses back then, because I, you know, I was in grade school, high school at that time, so it wasn't like I was working, but she gave me that first taste of, this is exactly what I want to do. Like, you are awesome. and then I got to, while in high school, and then again while I was in vet school, I shadowed another vet named Dr. Scott Owen. We're no relation, same last name, but no relation. And I learned a lot about the practice from him because I was, you know, a little bit older, a little bit more able to learn. So he kind of helped guide me even more. Since I've graduated, there's just been so many. You know, Dr. Johnston gave me my first job. I think that's always going to be a special part in my story. Dr. Chad Baumort, probably is one of the most influential in teaching me things. Like, I think you talk about your first 5 years of practice are probably when you learn the most. And I think he came in on my second year of practice, stayed with our practice for 2-3 years there. And I probably learned the most from him about just, you know, everything from ultrasound to how to really effectively work things up. And so I definitely think he had a big impact on my career. And I definitely can't thank the referral practices enough around here, because when I have something that's, you know, a little more than I can handle or something I need to know I'm doing right on, there's definitely some vets in this area, Dr. Lamb, Dr. B. Like, I can think of so many that I can thank for answering that phone late at night when I'm questioning things. And, you know, again, my new boss, Dr. Heatley, has taught me a lot about not only horses, but even other animals. And that's the thing. With the veterinary career, I feel like if you're not learning, if you think you've learned everything, you're probably being a little unrealistic with yourself. I think that's something, we call it continuing education, because there's always something more you can learn. And right. I have been very fortunate to have some really great mentors along the way. And I'm very thankful for all of them.
I would think that it's a job that you would need that, because like what you just said, it's not like if you're not able to reach out to people that have already been there and done that and talk to you about certain things, I mean, that's going to be a leg up. I would think you would need that to be a vet, to be a good vet, and to stay in the practice, as you know, for any amount of time.
Exactly, for sure.
Yeah, because it's not like you can just wake up one day and go, okay, well, I'm going to take a couple months and learn how to be a horse vet.
Some days I want to. I swear, even as long as I've practiced, I still some days I'm like, man, horses like to teach me that I don't know anything all the time. And, again, that's also that's the show industry. That's the veterinary industry. They're very humbling creatures. They will let you know that you are not there yet. About the time you think you're doing good, they'll teach you a new rule.
I love that, though. I love that about the horse, just the horse, the animal in itself, because it's like there's a quote where I stuck with me for so many years, you know, the horse could kill a person if they wanted to, but yet they stay so graceful and humble enough to carry them. And it's like I don't think people respect them enough that they really deserve. You know, if you think
about it in
that perspective.
I've never understood why they do it. Why do they let us ride them? I've never quite understood that. Because they don't have to.
Right. It's right.
But they do. They do. That's, you know, it's they're a wonderful creature. And I agree with you. I think sometimes we need to step back and take all our human emotions out of it and just go, hey, you know, the fact that they're even willing to work with us is pretty dang cool.
Yeah. And that was that one post that was online that kind of went viral for a while. It was a couple of years ago. And this girl, she pretty much put it in plain sight. She was like, you know, take the time to thank your horse, because, like, without the horse, you literally would not be here doing it. You would have nothing to complain
Correct.
About. You would have nothing to buy for. You would have nothing to do any of it. The entire industry owes the horse a massive thank you. But, well, okay, so that leads me into your showing career. So you started off showing dressage, obviously, right? And then
actually I grew up in hunter jumpers, so like over fences hunters. And that was the Alabama Hunter Jumper Association, and back then it's grown a lot since I was in it, but I started out, you know, like in the walk trot over Cavalettis, and then moved up to the 2'6", and then all the way up to the children's hunters, which is a 3-foot class.
Oh, wow.
So I did that from when I was 8 until Simon, my college horse, had to retire. Had a lot of great horses during that time. I had a horse named Trivial Pursuit. He took care of me over the big fences no matter what I did up there. He was a saint, and had several good coaches along the way, like I mentioned, Barbara Grubbs, and then Stephanie Howard as well. We're both really good mentors. When I came out here, I had been kind of out of the show industry for a little while, trying to get through vet school. I still rode. I never quit that. But I didn't show quite as hard as I used to, just trying to make sure I, you know, passed boards and could do what I wanted to do with my career. But once I was out here, I wanted to get back into it. And, you know, I met Chris about a little over a year into my practice. Like, I had already signed on for that second year as an associate after my internship was complete. And he's the one that helped me find Sassy. And when I got her, I just kind of, he said, why don't we just try things? So I showed in a little open horse show association out here and did the all around. And I learned many classes that I do not love. And I have a lot of respect for the people doing them. They are just not my thing.
Well, hold on. You can't say that without telling me what they are.
I am very impressed with showmanship. I am very untalented at it.
Really?
Yes. I can't run right. And I don't know what it is about the way I run, but something about the way I run makes my ponytail bob in a way that spooks every single horse I've ever tried to do showmanship with. It's not my calling. I also think I might fall on my face one day, and I figure I learned how to ride a horse so that I wouldn't have to do things on the ground. But again, incredibly impressed with their skill and talent, and especially because of the fact I'm so bad at it. Like, this is not a knock at all on that class. This is an inability to perform in that world. That's all then.
Oh.
I will leave it to them.
It is it is an art, actually. You are.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, that's not a knock. That is an inability to look like that on my part, and so I will just leave it to them.
But that's funny, but you said I learned how to ride, so I wouldn't walk.
I sure did. That's not my thing. I don't really particularly prefer the halter classes either, kind of the same reason. I feel like I should be in a saddle and we can go do things. But a lot of respect for everybody doing it. So anyway, I think I showed in that association for like a year or two, and then my husband was like, hey, there's this new thing coming out called ranch riding, and I feel like it might be something you're interested in. And so I kind of dabbled in it, and the mare, that first mare I had, Sassy, was actually in Appaloosa, and so they added it to their association, and they added it to their world show. And so I showed in the inaugural, like, ranch riding class in the open at their world show, because they didn't have a non-pro or anything. So I feel like I've been a part of, for the Appaloosa's ranch journey since it began. And I really realized that I loved ranch riding because it embodied what I liked about the hunters, which is that forward movement and, the ground covering stride, but put it into a format that I enjoyed, both with the pattern work and especially with the ranch trail, you know, and the challenging aspects of ranch trail. And I like that it's, again, more forward gates and being able to do things like drags and ropes and open gates and those kind of things. I think it's a really fun class. I think it's a very inviting class. And I've gone on to retire that mare. That mare was just such a wonderful, and she's out in my retirement field too. She actually had two colic surgeries over her career, and we actually
Hold on, she's had two colic surgeries, and you still continue to ride her?
Yes. So she had right dorsal displacements both times, and that is basically where the large intestine floats off and gets stuck somewhere it shouldn't. And we surgically corrected the first time. And she did really well, came back, we were showing, and I actually decided I was going to do hunters with her for a little while, and this is a little, like, 15-hand cow horse, right? Kind of an all-around bred, but more on the cow side. And I decided I'd do hunter hack with her, and so we actually went to the world show and did hunter hack, and I think I top 10'd her. And that was actually my first world show with the App Club, and we top 10 in both class and hunter hack. And I remember in the lineup afterwards, because you do the over fences portion and then a rail work portion, I remember being in the lineup, and I'm looking next to me, and I kind of had to look up at the riders surrounding me, because they're on horses that are good, I don't know, hand and a half taller than this little girl. But she did a really good job doing that. So we had done that, and then she had her first colic surgery, and I kind of decided – I really don't need to jump this mare anymore. I feel like that's putting strain on that abdomen. And I went on, and that's when I started doing the all around and everything, and led me to the ranch riding. And we had been competing in that for a while. And she had her second colic surgery. And at that point, I started riding my husband's retired rope horse. And, you know, that's a whole nother great story. He did really well and did some great things for me as well. But she came back from that second colic surgery, and then we were finally able to, she won a reserve national championship at the Appaloosa Nationals in Fort Worth. And that was kind of the year I decided it was her retirement. She earned my first trophy for me, and I, you know, she was starting to slow down a little bit after that second colic surgery. And I was like, I think it's time for her to be a happy retired horse. And so that is what she is doing. But yes, it is possible. And that's what I tell clients all the time. It is possible for them to come back from colic surgery and compete at or near their previous level. And she's living proof of that.
Because you're always kind of told it's too risky, or like it's not the same.
I think that's a misnomer. I will say, I think maybe she lost a little bit of her extension after the first surgery, and maybe just a touch more on the second. So I do think there is something, but she also was older at that point, so I don't know which of the two it was. But I think if they are going into the surgery with a good prognosis, I think they can come out with a great prognosis to return to work. And again, like we didn't win something fairly big until after her second one. So the second one, she had the same thing, a right dorsal displacement. So colon has floated off to where it shouldn't be. And we actually did something called a colapexy at that point, which actually attaches that intestine to the abdominal wall so it can't go floating off again. So she had a fairly significant surgery that second time, and is still, you know, now we're a good 8 years later, somewhere in that ballpark, and she's still doing great in her retirement. So it's not always a end of the career or end of whatever
right,
to have those colic surgeries. There's some that are riskier than others, obviously, but a lot of them can come back. So.
Yeah, I think that's good to hear, though, because, I mean, you know, like what I just said, when most people talk about that and you hear people talk about that and they've been through it, they're like, they're not the same, and then they don't ever show them again and things of that nature.
Yeah.
So it's good to hear that you've had that success story with her.
Yeah. And I know some other, you know, client-type horses in that same scenario where they've come back and been able to compete. So I think it's always something you should talk to the veterinarian that's doing the surgery for you and be realistic about it. But I think they got a chance if you're able to give it to them. I'm for it in the right time.
It
depends on what type of surgery was done. There's different ones, I think, that are a little harder on them to come back from. But you're in most surgeons' hands in about 3 months, you're kind of starting to leg them back up again.
Yeah.
I felt like she was pretty strong at like 6 months out. So,
uh-huh.
It's a little bit of rehab time, but I think it's doable.
And how long does it take?
The colic surgery itself or
yeah,
the
like
rehab?
The actual, like how long are you back there doing surgery?
Depends again on what is being done. Ones that have a displacement that's just basically open them and put things back where it should be can be really short procedures. I mean, you're talking from time of induction to recovery, I don't know, hour and a half, 2 hours. I've been in on some that were more like 3 to 4 hours.
That
they
is
were
so
really,
quick.
They can be quick. In a skilled surgeon's hand, they can be really quick. I was scrubbed in
like
on some that
hours
was longer.
And
no,
like
no, it is definitely faster than that. Like, and it's important to be relatively quick because we're talking about a very large animal with very large pressure on their lungs. So ventilation is really important for them. And if they're in a certain position for too long, you know, they can start having some fluid accumulation in lungs and secondary complications. So it's important for that to be a pretty concise surgery, and the skilled surgeons can make it look really easy. Like, it's impressive to me what they can do. But that's kind of the ballpark time frame.
That's absolutely mind-blowing to me. I think that's cool that you – it's
almost talked as if it's like nothing. Like, oh yeah, about a couple hours. Well, you know, we'll be done with it. I'm like, oh my God.
I don't know that it's nothing.
In that sense. I didn't say it in that sense. I'm saying it in the sense of 2 hours to do a major pelvic surgery is very, like, it's not that big of a deal. Even though, yes, we know it's a big deal. But
time frame wise, we're not in there forever. Some of the ones where you're actually like resecting something, so basically taking a piece out and then anastomosis, which is putting it back together, those can take longer because you're trying to actually recreate the intestinal tract. And so obviously it's a little bit more involved, and those can get a little bit longer, you know, 3-4 hours even. But either way, you're not looking at like your concept of like 8 hours, you know, or overnight or anything. It's not like, I don't know, some of the medical shows on Grey's Anatomy where they're talking about standing there forever doing something. We're not quite that level. So.
That's crazy how the misconception can kind of linger. Like, you know, you have these misconceptions of how things are. So I think it's cool to be able to kind of hear that it's not like that or it is like that. And
right.
And the fact that you have to, you know, the space that you guys have in order to do a large animal. I mean, a horse is not like a dog, you know.
It is not.
The team that you have to have to do that, it's got to be at least, how many people do you have to have?
Oh, you've got to have, for sure, and I mean, you can run them on pretty small teams, but anesthesiologist, a surgeon, you'd like to have somebody scrubbed in with the surgeon as an assist, and then a runner that can go grab things that you need. So, you know, you'd like to have at least a team of four and preferably more than that, but you can bare minimum it kind of around that 3-4 number, depending on how you place your staff.
Do you have like a machine that brings the horse in there to you?
Yes.
I mean, how many people does it take, or how long does it take to get a horse into an operating room?
So in a really trained, like well-run facility, you're inducing them, and then you're putting them on a hoist that it's usually a one-ton winch, and it will lift them up in the air. You can roll the surgery table up under them, and then you roll the surgery table into the surgical suite. And a lot of different hospitals have different setups to make that happen, but they usually have an induction room, a surgical room, and then a recovery room.
Of
those are connected by a hoist that can roll in and out of different places it needs to be.
That's so cool. That's so interesting. But you're used to that. I mean, you know, it's your daily life.
That's just an everyday, vision for us. But I remember when it wasn't. I remember being just astounded that these things can be, we can do this. Like, we can actually put this horse under, you know, completely and be able to correct things like this, you know, in a hospital. Like, it is astounding when you really sit back and think about it, even though it's become commonplace to me. I can still see where, looking from the outside in, you know, it definitely gives you that unique perspective of, like, what is actually happening there and how cool it is.
Yeah. Yeah, that is really very cool. Now, did you as far as your back to your horse show career, back to your horse show career, you guys are showing in Oklahoma now. What are you guys showing at now?
We just got done with the Pinto World Championship show, and we are now, and that was in Tulsa, and we are now down in Oklahoma City at the Appaloosa National Show.
Very cool.
So had a really good Pinto show for sure. and going
well
at now.
He's pretty much said that he's ranch and came from all around into ranch, but you keep saying breed shows. Are you just showing specifically ranch classes at these breed shows?
That and you know, sometimes some of the all-around type associations too. I mean, we've showed in the ARHA before too. Basically trying to just find ranch shows to go to. You know, again, he grew up in the all-around, and when I met him, he was team roping. I'm the one that drug him over into the show world again. But we definitely, we show in the apps, we show in the Pintos. We have shown a paint and a quarter and a couple others. I've shown at some of the level one quarter stuff back a long time ago with his rope horse, actually, that we converted to a ranch rider. And did really well. Like, I think he was third in the level one ranch riding, which was really cool for me because
the one quarter show I had done. But yeah, we just basically try to do ranch riding classes in any of those associations. And then we've shown in some of the ARHA and Stock Course Alliance as well.
Are you guys particularly Pinto and Paint, Pinto and Appaloosa only?
No, we have a quarter going as well that we'll hopefully be showing in some of the quarter horse stuff next year as he ages into it. We've shown some of the paint stuff. We just happen to have right now mostly Pinto, which can be a lot of breeds, as well as apps at the moment. But we've got some up and coming other breeds as well. I think to me and probably my husband as well, a good horse is a good horse. And I have two really good Appaloosas right now, and I enjoy showing them in all breed type classes just because I think they are good horses, and it's fun to go show off that breed, which I think sometimes has a little bit of a stigma against it, and be like, hey, these are good horses. They are really fun to show. They're really talented at what they do. I think wherever I can show a good horse is kind of where I want to show. good horse comes in any breed. You just got to find them.
Yes. No. Okay. So you guys are all around breed, but particularly just ranch. Is that what I'm getting?
Yes. So breed is not as important to me. In fact, my husband even trains a Morgan. So not even just straight stock horses. A good horse is a good horse if it can do the ranch classes. Who am I to say what breed matters? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. No. We all know that. I just meant your particular plate. You guys will take any breed, but you just concentrate on ranch.
Yes. We don't do any of the all around. We dabbled in that both and decided that wasn't for us. And, so we stay pretty primarily in the ranch industry.
Yeah. That's definitely been up and coming since I think I read where it first kind of come around in 2016, and it's crazy that it's grown up so much, but we've talked about it a lot on other episodes about how it's a more friendlier atmosphere and people kind of like it because it's a little more laid back. Not that it's less competitive, it's very competitive, but I think it's more laid back to say like, dressage events and hunt seat events or even other disciplines that you do. I think that's what attracts people to it. Can you agree to that or?
I can. And again, I grew up in the hunter industry, so I've seen that industry. Chris grew up in the all around and he's seen that. And I think as a whole, I think the ranch industry is a little more welcoming and inviting. I think it's a little easier to get into. You don't have to have quite as much of the fancy equipment at those lower starting levels. Especially, even in some of these local open show associations, it's very easy to integrate into the ranch classes versus, having to find a saddle with silver and expensive show outfits to do some of the other Western events. So I think for people coming into this industry, it definitely is more open and welcoming. And I think they're fun to show. That's what attracts me the most is, of all the things I've shown, that's actually what I enjoy riding and enjoy going and showing. So I think once you get into it, I think it wants to keep you there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's just it's a little more laid back, which is good. And, I mean, not that you can't spend a lot of money on a hunt seat saddle or a dressage saddle or even a ranch saddle, but a lot of people are going to that. Do you think that's going to do a kind of dwindle off and go back into it? Do you think it's a trend or do you think it's something that's kind of set that's going to be more popular as
the entry or like more people coming into this industry or into the ranch riding type events?
Just ranch riding in general.
I think it'll continue to grow, and I think that's evidenced by different shows adding money into their program to build the ranch riding. I think watching the horse market for ranch riders, they definitely increased in prices. And I think, every day on Facebook you see looking for this ranch riding horse or that. So I see it continuing to grow because I think it's just such a fun event. And there's so many things within it that you can do from trail to riding to cow work, depending on what discipline within the ranch classes you want to do, that it kind of opens the door to people that want to work cows as well as people that want to do patterns. And I think there's a place for everyone with the leveling system, so that you get to stay in that and find a place you fit. So I feel like it is going to continue to grow and continue to be a successful endeavor. And I hope that it is, because I kind of like doing it, so I'd like it to stick around.
Right. Yeah, because that's what you primarily do now. And you do, and you guys, so have you guys competed against each other, you and your husband?
Oh, yeah, and he's better than I am, I'll tell you that any day. So that usually reflects in play things. But, you know, I try to be, I think I beat him one time. I can't remember, but I think I did beat him one time. And I think I remember being really ecstatic about that, because to me that was probably better than the fact that, you know, maybe I won that class, or I don't even remember what placing I got, but I think I had a moment where I actually got to beat him, and that was just really a good day, because he's just very talented.
He's got one on him.
I do, and it might be that only one, and that might be the only one, but hey, I had it.
Hey, it's there. Can't nobody take it from you, so.
Correct.
It is
Correct.
What it is. Now, what do you guys see? Are you guys going to see yourself staying in Oklahoma? And since that's what kind of where everything's at, because it is pretty busy out there. I mean, like, that's the place to go. That in Texas is not far from you either. Obviously, everybody loves going down there.
Right. I feel like we'll probably stay here at least for a very long time. You know, the horse industry is so strong here. I can't see us leaving. The only time I ever want to leave is the weather out here is just so insane sometimes. You know, just this week we had a storm that went through parts of my practice area that had 80-mile-per-hour wind and baseball-sized hail. I mean,
oh my God.
Those are hard things to live with in Oklahoma. And you know, we get the ice storms and everything else. So I think we get all the weather extremes, and sometimes that makes me want to leave. Right now we're in excessive heat warnings with a real feel around 115.
Holy crap!
So the state itself can be challenging, but the horse community is worth staying around. We jokingly say one day we're going to retire to Florida, because both of us have a lot of like arthritis from over the years, and we talk about moving to where it's never cold one day. But I think we'll stay in the industry here for a long time first.
Yeah, because Alabama is a lot different kind of weather than Oklahoma weather.
It is a more humid beast. You know, everybody talks about the humidity out here, and I'm like, I really just don't think you know what humidity is, because if you go to Alabama or Louisiana or Mississippi or any of those, you're down there in like 80-90% humidity, and that's a whole nother beast. I don't think the temps get as high there, but it's definitely challenging itself just with that humidity. And they still get the tornadoes, and they get the added hurricanes. So I don't know that there's a perfect place to live weather-wise. So I think I'll just stay with the horse industry I like.
Right. Just deal with the hail. It's not that big of a deal. It's like a snow cone.
Just hope I get lucky.
Right. Well, and then now you guys are going to be where you're at now for, what, the end of the weekend? Or how long are you guys out there till you get to go back home?
I think we come back on Tuesday. I think the show goes through Wednesday, but I believe we're done showing Tuesday. I think one of our riders may still be there till Wednesday, but I think I'm done by Tuesday at least.
Yeah, because you guys have customers and customer horses there. How many horses you got total there?
Chris has a total of four down there, three of which are his horses. They're my two, and then one client horse. And then we have she also has an all-around horse, which he doesn't really help her with that part, because he wants to stay on the ranch side, but we're there to support her for it. So we had a really big crew go into Pinto World. I think we took 9 horses there. A little bit smaller on the app side, but still a good show. And we've had a couple champions and reserve champions down at the show so far, so it's going well.
Yeah, apps are not crazy. I don't care what anybody says.
No, I love them. Like, that was the first experience for me showing in breed shows, was being able to show in the app industry, and that Sassy Mare was a saint and let me show in everything from the Overfences class to Western Pleasure until ranch riding came around, and then she let me do that too. So I have a very fond feeling for that breed because it let me learn what I actually am passionate about. And then the two I've got now, High Caliber Gun and Frozen Heine, I think they are both really talented and have let me really truly learn how to ride a ranch rider. They were bred more to do that than Sassy was. She was more of that kind of all-around breeding. But these two are a little bit more geared down the ranch side. And I think that is really, again, made me like that breed for what it has given to me. And I, like I always said, a good horse is a good horse no matter what color it came in.
Yeah, no, I was raised on a register app. She was a bay, and she had no color. Her mama had she was a roan with about half of her body had a blanket on her, and her daddy was a quarter horse. She's your average chestnut quarter horse. So I was raised on an Appaloosa mare, and I'm going to tell you something. They have a heart that's hard to duplicate, and you put it into perfect words. They literally will give you everything that they can. They will try to give you everything that they can, and she did that for me, too, so but they still have a bad stigma, just like people call Arabs crazy and all of them crazy. Well, but who cares? They're not crazy.
They're not. And I think that the stigma comes from the fact if you see a bay quarter horse out there doing something bad, you probably couldn't pick that horse out of a crowd again of 30, you know, bay sorrel quarter horses to say that's the one that was bad. But you see a leopard app out there being bad, you're going to remember that leopard app. So it's just it's a difference in memory, you know. And there are some apps out there that are not great. I'll say that. But I think
that's
that can be said
horses.
In any breed. Exactly. That's exactly the thing there for me, is I think that can be any of those breeds. Think it's just a little more memorable when they're loudly spotted.
But I will give you this. The Pinto and the Paint has really come – I mean, they are really doing their own thing and really kind of setting the bar high. From what I can see and what I've been told, just, you know, APHA in general and Pinto, they really are kind of stepping it up out there, even adding the ranch stuff that
Absolutely.
They have now and stuff. People
Absolutely.
Really like going to their shows.
And they're getting a lot of added money, too, and I think that helps the industry grow. Because when you take a horse down there and you do well, it's nice to be able to earn some of that money back because we all know we're spending a ton to be there. So it's nice to be able to have a chance to get rewarded for that work and that all that time you spent in the saddle. And I think the Paint Club is doing a really good job of promoting their ranch industry. So I definitely applaud that. So I think we're definitely headed in the right direction for sure.
Yeah. Well, that's good that you guys are, doing what you're doing and got what you've got going there. Are you open to new customers, or are you guys kind of cut off and you get what you can get and stick with what you've concentrated on right now, or?
I can't speak to my husband's training side 100%, but I think he's always willing to work with people of like mind and like that want to go on and do right by the horse and be a part of that ranch industry. So I think he's always got a spot for that person coming along. And I definitely, in the veterinary community, I will work to a fault probably and continue to overwork a little bit sometimes, but I love what I do. And so I always tell people I'll help them out if they need it. So I'm always open for new clientele there that way. It's interesting being able to watch that difference from a non-pro perspective in the veterinary industry as well as watching my husband in the trainer side. So I think it just gives you a whole new perspective on all of that and being able to see it from all aspects for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, are you guys wanting to just grow is what I'm asking. Like, you're going to continue to just grow or kind of stay where you're at?
Well, it's always the goal. I feel like it is always the goal to get better and grow no matter what we're talking about. And that can be in my riding career, in my veterinary practice, because I think if you get complacent, you stop improving. I want to continue to ride against tougher riders to make myself better. Like I said, I kind of started out in like some open show events and thought I was doing really good when I was winning there. And I think I went to the NSBA World Championship one time and realized that I probably had some more homework to do. And that sent me home to work harder and to learn a little bit more and get better. And that's how I got better, by being challenged by better riders. So I think the ultimate goal is to always step up to the next segment in the horse industry, get a little bit better and keep trying to improve yourself. And I'd like to see, you know, I think my husband would like to see his training stuff grow and get even more down. You know, he's come a long way in the very short time since he started training officially again, kind of to help me out more than anything else. I kind of suckered him into being a trainer again, but since he's been doing it for about 3 years, you know, he's had a lot of success in it. And I think he'd like to continue to grow that and grow the program and do more.
Yeah, but you guys don't do any breeding or anything like that as far as raising your own and training and buying and selling. You just strictly stick to training and showing?
We actually have a couple brood mares. You know, I've got a nap brood mare and a quarter brood mare, and we've got a yearling and a two-year-old quarter paint cross. I've got a colt on the side of my app mare, and she is carrying another one for next year. So we do a little bit, and we sell a few along the way. And so we dabble in that, but we just, with the facility we have, that we don't have like a big area to do a huge breeding program, but we want to create one or two for ourselves coming up every year. So starting to get into breeding, kind of dabbling in it in the last few years.
Well, that'll be fun.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Hoping we get some success with some of these we've got going. You know, the two-year-old's starting to get broke out and everything. He's looking pretty good so far, so hopefully that continues.
It's a different feeling when you raised it and trained it and showed it than you can love them both, and I'm not trying to make one better than the other, but it's a different feeling, because that's how it was with my mare. Like, they, you know, my parents bred her mom and her dad, and we literally raised her from when she hit the ground, and I showed her, and then she buried out on the hill. It's a completely different feeling when you get out there and you're riding one that you just, like, you raised, and you see it grow
Absolutely.
Up and stuff.
That's what I'm hoping we get to feel in the next few years is watching this one come up and be able to do the job we want him to do, because he's got a lot of potential. He's a good-looking little red roan colt, and I'm hoping he takes after what we think he's going to be.
Aww. Well, I mean, you never know. I mean, you don't never know what they're capable of doing and that type of stuff, and, you know, you don't know that.
No.
That's the gamble with life, period. But it is cool. It's just a different feeling. You know, I bet you could probably relate to one that you've had for a really long time, and you trained it, and you're out there, and you're showing, and then you win something, and you do something. It's just a feeling that it's indescribable compared to just if you're doing it as a job and as a business. You kind of set those emotions off and keep them off. And keep it business.
Well, I think that's definitely true. Like the first time I won a title, that's definitely a moment you remember. Somebody along the way told me that the ones you remember the most are the first one you win and the last. And I think that may be a fair statement. Granted, there's a lot of really high peaks in the middle there, I hope, for the other wins. But I think those may be some of the most memorable ones.
Yeah, or just a mere accomplishment, not even necessarily winning anything, but just like, you know, I remember when I was trying to teach my horse how to side pass, and this was back in the 90s, like this was where you didn't have clinics, you didn't have YouTube, you didn't have the internet to help you out. You were just out there on your own. And I remember trying to teach my horse how to side pass, something so simple, and it took so long, you know, to figure it out and to get it
there.
I remember the first time she finally done it, it was like, I have won the world. This is,
The aha moment.
It's an amazing feeling, you know?
Yes, that light bulb moment. I think that's a lot of horse riding. You'll go along and be frustrated, and then it just turns on, and you're like, oh, my God, that was it. I definitely know that feeling. And sometimes, and unfortunately, sometimes you revert back to, oh, my gosh, I don't know how to do this. And then you have to have that light bulb moment again. And I think that especially for us non-pros, like for Chris, it's sometimes second nature, and he just doesn't understand why we can't remember it. And I'm out there fiddling and messing up the same thing 20 times and going, what was that again? But when you get it right, I think it's such a good feeling because it's amazing. It's like you're a partner with that horse, and it gives you that moment where it's the two of you doing something correct, and it can
be
so cool.
Well, I mean, it's not like you can take him and put him in the operating room. It would be the flip switch on it, you know?
Right. I think that's a valid point. I've never considered it. It was probably the same for him in my industry, but
it would be the same thing, because like what you just said, it's second nature to him. He doesn't have to think about it. It's not that he's not continuing to learning and all that blah blah blah, we got
that part.
Like, he does it for a living, he knows what he's doing, and so it cannot, I don't want to say it want to get, I wonder if it, this is probably a good question, I wish I would have asked him, if it gets less special every time that something like that happens compared to somebody like me or you who doesn't do it for a living. We're there for the fun, we're there for the thrill, and it's, you know, to accomplish something that little. See what?
I don't think it does for him. At least he's always said, this is something that I kind of value in his thought perspective, is that it's not about his wins, it's about the horse's wins. So for him, it is more about what the horse can earn, and he's just kind of the facilitator. So I think each individual horse has that same pathway to that aha moment. So I don't know that, I feel like every time there is a win for one, it's still just as exciting for him. I don't know that ever dulls. So
yeah, or any accomplishment is exciting, I think, to be able to do with a horse. So
for sure,
or to do, it's not like it's, I don't know, it's just, it, they're, like we said, we already said this, they're amazing creatures. They don't get
They really are. So. They really
well,
are.
Well, I thoroughly appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today, and because you have to go show.
I do, and I think somebody might be, I'm actually not showing today. I don't show again until tomorrow, but I do think somebody
his
client's show today, so I'm going to go cheer for them. But I am actually off today. Yep. I think that's a very important thing to go do is cheer for your teammates. So I'm going to go cheer for my teammates.
Well, I'll be cheering for y'all from North Carolina.